Okay, guys, once we're through this door, it's Defeat the Dragon and Claim the Sword of the Mythcreant Podcast.
I've got my plot shield equipped.
Magic missile ready.
Why are we on a spaceship?
It's my shield. Force field. It has +2 to plot convenience.
And we're conveniently on the USS Mythcreant Podcast.
Convenient? We're headed towards an alien armada.
Readying the improbability drive.
The shields are down 50%. I'm not sure we can survive another moral analogy.
Oh, now what?
It's a graveyard. Is it just me, or is this world a bit inconsistent?
Spooky fog, full moon, empty mansion. It's genre consistent, anyway.
Here lies the Mythcreant Podcast. May its speculative fiction madness never again threaten the world of men?
I want to go back to the dragon.
World of men? That's kind of sexist, isn't it?
Yeah, there are other options for efficient gender-neutral pronoun use.
I have no idea what you just said.
We'll just have to dig up the podcast and find out.
Wait. There's a bit of fine print here.
On a gravestone?
A podcast analyzing aspects of fantasy, science fiction, and horror. Downloadable from mythgreens.com, iTunes, and Stitcher Radio.
Come on, guys. These eldritch grave seals aren't going to break themselves.
Maybe you shouldn't do that.
And welcome, everyone, to another episode of All Things Trek. I'm Oren.
I'm Grace.
I am David.
And we have a returning guest, and that is Bob.
Yo.
Yay.
Hi, Bob.
Hi, Bob.
So did you know that you were 11 days shy of 3 years of All Things Trek?
What?
Actually, I did not know that. Is that our three-year anniversary? I'd lost track of when it was.
Well, you see, if you use the website www.allthingstrek.com and actually go back to the older post, you can see that the first episode was posted on June 18th.
Does it? Okay.
Oh,
I thought,
man.
I didn't realize the dates would carry over because we changed websites. I guess Sori was more devoted than I realized.
Man,
well, I got with him to make sure that everything was good at the time.
Well, you and him then. But I did invite you on because I knew this was kind of close to our three-year anniversary. You know, we're at, like, episode 150, and we skipped a few here and there. But so that's why I wanted you back, because I figured that was fitting.
There's actually another fun fact, is that episode 3 is still missing.
Well, it's not missing. It was just crap. The reason we didn't post that one is because it was just really, really bad.
What was the one that was missing then?
That one we found. That was episode 18, and I found it. I don't remember where it was exactly, but I found it. Like, episode 3 was, like, we recorded it, and there was something wrong with the recording, and it was all, like, super, like, blah, 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 sound.
So it's been purged from continuity?
Yeah, it's just gone. But,
yeah,
all right. So, before we get into our main topic, we have an email. It is from, once again, the Pastel Nerd, and the subject is rewatch time. So I would like to endeavor to rewatch all of Star Trek, though I guess I wouldn't be rewatching all of it because I'm fairly certain I've missed a few episodes and I've never seen the motion picture. I've seen most of it over the years, though not in any sort of order, just whenever it was on TV or I felt like watching an episode on Netflix. So I would like to watch it in order, but which order? Do I watch TOS in production order or air order? Should I watch Enterprise first or last? Should I overlap my watching of TNG, DS9, and Voyager because that's how they came out? Or one after the other. When do I watch the movies? Have you answered this question before? You have a lot of episodes. Thanks for your time, Pastel Nerd. So
I'm gonna let you field this one, Oren.
I was gonna ask for all of what you guys all think because I don't know if there's a right answer to this question. I personally tend to watch them in in air date order just to keep them, just to keep everything straight, because I don't want to have to hunt down the production order and, like, you know, and then I'll watch one series after another because I don't want to have to figure out, okay, so when did this DS9 episode air? Did it air before this Voyager episode? So, you know, I generally start TOS, watch it in air order, and then I just go through from each series. And I'll, like, I watch the movies after I finish watching whatever series they were part of. So, you know, I watch the TOS movies after I watch the TOS series, and then I watch DS9 movies after the... Did I say DS9 movies? There are no DS9 movies.
That would have been nice, yeah.
Would have been weird, though. They would have had to spend, like, the first half of the episode getting the cast back together. So that's, you know, my theory. And then I don't know if you need to watch Enterprise at all, but if you feel like watching it...
It's good to see some things just don't change.
Nothing,
nope.
You know, that's like they say at the end of Deep Space Nine, the more they change, the more they stay the same. But if you know...
You know, I think if I had the option, I would rewatch them all in the in-universe chronological order, if I had the option.
Yeah, but part of the enjoyment that comes with Enterprise, if any, is all the in-world references they make to previous stuff that's already happened, you know, in previous shows.
Or that hasn't happened.
Yeah. It's just the in-world references are what makes, are part of the fun of it, and you won't really get those if you haven't been exposed to the other stuff.
Watching Enterprise first also means you won't have to end with These Are the Voyages, which is possibly the most depressing episode of Star Trek ever made.
Fair enough.
So I think I'd endorse that. I think I'm going to change my recommendation and say watch them in universe order. That way you don't have to end with Enterprise.
Well, and then for the most part, I would think, you know, you could just watch like all of TOS, then go to all of, you know, and then Voyager doesn't have to be an overlap. But the only time I think I would overlap anything would be with TNG and then DS9, because, you know, for people that have already seen it or heard about it, you know, it's probably not a spoiler, but the pilot and the story of DS9 starts off with the aftermath or being affected by what happens in The Best of Both Worlds. So if you really wanted to, like, you know, go as they happen, you know, in universe, once you get to all Best of Both Worlds, start DS9, then kind of overlap them. But that it would take a lot of planning and, you know,
actually,
looking
you
at
wouldn't
it.
Yet.
No, what part of the pilot do is set during Best of Both Worlds, and then it continues to
it
years later.
Yeah, it jumps forward.
Yeah, so this is how you do it here. You do start TNG, then when you get to Best of Both Worlds, right where the battle scene starts, you watch the beginning of Emissary, then you turn off Emissary.
God.
As soon as the battle's done, then you keep watching TNG.
This is getting needlessly complicated.
Up to Season 5, then you start DS9, then you're going to finish TNG and DS9. You finish TNG, you keep watching DS9, then you're going to start Voyager at about Season 3 of DS9?
Something like that. But remember, you got to watch Generations, like, between the... You got to get to the Season 3 of Deep Space Nine, then you have to watch Generations, because that's apparently when Generations happened, because, like, we hear about Worf and the Enterprise exploding in the beginning of Season 4 of Deep Space Nine.
We're doing this.
So, we should actually, like, map it out. Maybe, like, on Memory Alpha, Beta, some other site, or allthingstrek.com. Just, like, have, like, viewing order, and then, like, you could have production. One list is production order, which I kind of don't recommend anybody watch it like that. But then, you want to watch it, you know, chronologically, then boom, here's the big, you know, list of the ordering of everything.
I think we're going to need, like, a loose change style corkboard to keep track of all this.
No, what we need to do is do, like, a big wall collage conspiracy-style thing, like, connected with bits of string, with dates circled and involved parties written down. That's the only way we can do it and have any fun, really.
All right, well, consider that to be our next All Things Trek project. But thank you, Pastel Nerd, for the email. And now it is time for our main topic, which is, since this is sort of All Things Trek's third anniversary, kind of.
Anniversary-ish.
Yeah, the anniversary light, as it were.
Ishiversary. Anniversary-eh.
Very good, Grace. I figured that we would talk about the two episodes of Star Trek that marked the 30th anniversary of the franchise. because that was the only big anniversary that was actually that actually happened while Star Trek was on air, because like the 20th anniversary was the year that that Next Gen came out. So obviously they didn't have a giant 20th anniversary party. That was just like, hey, we launched a new show. Here's your anniversary. And by the 40th anniversary, Star Trek was already off the air. Great sadness. But the 30th anniversary, we had two Star Treks going on. This was like golden age of Star Trek. And both of them did a big old episode commemorating that it had been 30 years since the original series launched. And of course, those two series were Deep Space Nine and Voyager. So first, we will be talking about the DS9 episode, Trials and Tribulations. And I invited Bob here because I know how much he loves time travel.
Did you ever show that picture to everybody?
Oh, I should have. Okay, after the show, you can go to the All Things Trek Facebook page, and you will get to see Bob's interpretation of a Starfleet time travel officer. But, so the recap, for anyone who doesn't remember, I guess, this is the episode where they go back in time and see Tribbles, and also interact with a bunch of original series footage, because why not? Now, the first question that I want to ask all you guys is, what is up with temporal investigations? Because these guys show up and
I don't
like,
know, but I love them.
Why do you like them, Grace? Explain.
I specifically like them in this episode because they just hate the world. They hate their jobs, and they hate everyone they have to interact with.
Well, we were just talking about, you know, the whole chronology, and imagine them having to, you know, fix timeline. They're basically like time cops, or not maybe cops, but, you know, the time investigators that have to, like, you know, fix the problem. Now, here, that was one of my questions. I did like them, and, you know, they dress stylishly, so that's cool. They don't have uniforms, they just wear suits, and I remember in some of the production stuff, they were kind of, you know, homage or playing off of Scolder and Mully.
Mully and... Scolder and Moldy. I don't think that's right, dude. No, I thought they were kind of like the futuristic Men in Black kind
Scully
of
Scully and Mulder, right. Well, some of their yeah. names are kind of a playoff of that, but I always thought, okay, so they're coming in to investigate, right? They're asking a bunch of questions, taking notes. I thought, so what happens if Sisko and some other ship really do screw things up? Do they have the ability to go change it and fix it, or do they just have to document it? And so that was the thing that I wanted to know more. Like, you know, Starship Troopers, would you like to know more? Like, yeah, I like them.
I really would want to know, like you said, do they have time travel ability? I mean, my guess would be no, but then again, I guess in Star Trek IV, we did see that anyone can go back in time as long as they can slingshot around the sun.
Maybe they're the only people allowed to. They're the ones with that technology.
It's also kind of humorous to imagine them just back at their office. They have all the documents of all the alternate timelines that we've been through because, you know, the on-screen crew is like going back in time like every other week. And if we assume that this is happening to other people, because why would it only be happening to them? Like, you know, in other people all around the galaxy, it's like the timeline is constantly changing all the time. And I'd like to imagine they know. They can't do anything about it, but they know. They have it all.
Oh,
right,
man.
That's why they're so cranky. They've got such a convoluted job.
Imagine their cork board with all the push pins and string.
Exactly, yeah.
It'd be like and then
five
there was
warehouses full of cork board.
Then there was this Krenim guy over in the Delta Quadrant, and he was just changing the timeline, like, every week, and, like, nobody noticed. We were really, like, everyone thinks we're crazy, but we swear, like, you know, the sky used to be orange. Like, that was just a thing, but now it's not anymore. We're the only ones who remember.
Someone has to remember. Someone must always remember.
No, I'm not a fan of temporal investigations.
You don't like them much, Bob?
No, because really, this is the root of everything that is wrong with time travel in Star Trek.
Enlighten us.
Well, I mean, prior to this, you had the whole, we're going to go back in time by either slingshotting around the sun, or it was an accident. And there really wasn't too much follow-up, because things were the way they needed to be after their time travel incident most of the time, or they went back and they had to make things right, as in the case of, like, sitting on the edge of forever. Right? It's just like, this is the way things need to be. We're going to just make it right. And there wasn't really any follow-up to it. They just made their report, and Captain Kirk saved the world from the Nazis by letting the woman die on the road. So everything was cool, right? Now we've got temporal investigations that comes along, and they got to file their report saying, what flavor of time travel did you experience? Was it predestination? Was it an accident? And I'm confident this is how things have become so convoluted as far as time travel is concerned further on in the series.
So basically,
so you think they're just a sign of that plot device getting tossed around too much?
Yes.
Temporal Investigations is an in-universe acknowledgement that at how dumb Star Trek time travel is.
Yeah, that's how it was supposed to be, but then someone took it and ran with it, and it was like, oh, this is a great idea, guys, let's keep doing this. It's just like, stop.
Well, in fairness, they only ever showed up once in that Deep Space Nine episode.
Well, yeah, but, you know, I can get hit by a car once, doesn't mean I'm not going to be paralyzed for life and have lasting, you know, repercussions from it.
Are you really comparing these characters to paralyzing the Star Trek universe?
As far as the time travel crap is concerned,
God, for me, it is.
I mean, I can understand that. Like, it's one of those things where a lot of the Star Trek writers were like, let's do this for fun, and they didn't, you know, really think about what the implications were for the universe, right? Like, the episode where they have the gun that shoots warp waves is another one of those, where it's like, no one really considered, you know, this would be a very effective weapon, even if it's not very effective for moving ships around. Like, this would have been really handy to have during the Dominion War.
Honestly, guys, for all we know, like, the Temporal Investigations guys didn't even exist a week later. For all we know, they just existed for, like, that occasion alone, and then they were deleted from existence.
You know, considering they never paid Jake Sisko a visit in The Visitor, that was a pun, I didn't mean for it to be one.
That's more than likely.
I think they were probably wiped out of existence.
Well, and then before why didn't they show up during the Bell riots during past tense, that whole thing? But the thing I kind of took it also was kind of like a tongue-in-cheek poke at, like, you know, how by this time in the Trek universe, things are just so bureaucratic that there's, like, you know, investigators, catalogers.
Yeah, that's how I took it.
You know, for everything. It's like every little thing, there's got to be some, it's got to be filed, or, you know, investigated, reported, filed away, and then probably just forgotten about. But, you know, I don't think they play a major role.
That's why I thought it was funny. Like, we're talking about time travel, this big, fantastic concept, and there are these guys who are just like, oh, great. We have to talk about this all day. Yay. And that's part of what makes it funny. And that's part of what just gives a funny opening to the episode, I think. And makes for a good bookending with the start and finish.
Also, as a minor note, this episode has, I think, the most quotes of any episode on Memory Alpha. Like, you know, Memory Alpha
really?
has that section for, like, famous quotes, and I think this one has the most. It has a huge section. It's like they almost quoted the entire episode.
It's just the script put up on there?
Almost.
They just put it down, copy and pasted.
If you read the background information, supposedly the DS9 writing staff was, like, going out for pizza to talk about this episode, and they just happened to run into Charlie Brill, who is the actor of Darvin, like, as they were out getting pizza. Supposedly this happened, which leads me to believe that maybe this was a predestination paradox.
Uh-oh.
This was something the Lord wanted.
It was the fates. But that was a cool thing. And we're going to get to the Voyager one, you know, later. But the thing that I liked about this episode was that they did bring back Arne Darvin. And, you know, seeing him, you know, obviously from pictures and his younger self from the original TOS episode. But then to bring him back and to see, you know, the current one and that they're dealing with him and he's messing with the timeline and stuff. So I was happy to see him back and, you know, blending, seeing how he goes forward. And the episode Voyager that we'll get to later had more returning people, original previous characters, if I remember right. But at least for this one, we had Arne Darvin, which I always liked that character. And it was just a, you know, crazy storyline and fun. So seeing him interact with Worf and the O'Brien and Bashir in the galley or, in those quarters at the beginning, it was kind of cool.
It's also pretty fun to see how the character has aged and not so much changed his ways, but goes about them differently.
Well, he has a much more, like, I would say, flamboyant flair than is common.
I was going
to
say
later...
sprightly, but yeah.
Yeah, and, like, he has, I think that he has kind of a more 1960s Star Trek-esque, like, feeling to him where like back then when they were still kind of adapting to television and more, they were using more theater acting techniques where everything is like bigger and which looks a little odd on screen nowadays. But I thought he did that kind of interestingly. He's also the fourth actor in DS9 to reprise his TOS role, and all four of them were Klingons, incidentally.
Oh, there you go.
It's a good show for Klingons, I guess.
Yeah, it is a bit. All right, so now let's talk about the TOS parts of this story, because so they use some original TOS footage, and they do a pretty good job, apparently using like the technology that was pioneered for Forrest Gump to insert the DS9 actors like into the background of those shots.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, because I noticed that, like, you know, they've done it for years where it's like they find an empty spot and they superimpose the other person there, and sometimes it looks seamless and sometimes it don't. But you could tell, like, oh, they're just stuck in this corner and they don't move because of, you know, they're having to just stick them into the shot. Where in this time, when Sisko and Dax, like, run into or in the corridor, they see Kirk and Spock, they're walking behind Kirk and Spock, and it looks seamless. Like, it doesn't look like, you know, distorted lines or anything. It just looks like they're really walking behind Kirk and Spock, so they did a good job with that.
You get to see, like, the scene happening while Dax is checking out Spock in the background. It's good stuff. It's also a really good example of how changes in motion picture technology, even if it's something kind of niche-like for like, say, Forrest Gump, like you were saying, can be utilized and reused in the future, and that's just neat to think about.
And I noticed there's like, when you're watching it on, like, I have a decent sized TV, like, it's not the biggest, but it's decent size. If you look closely, you can see a little bit of fuzziness around the Deep Space Nine actors when they're inserted into shots, but if you're not looking for it, you definitely would, it would seem seamless. And I think my favorite is the part where Kirk sits on a tribble and he looks over at Dax. It looks like he's looking over at Dax. I don't know what he was looking at in the original shot. I haven't seen that episode for a while.
It was just like another, not a red shirt, but like a random person sitting at, like, you know, on the side of the console. I think it was a gold shirt.
And like Dax kind of shrugs at him. So, you know, there was that nice little bit of interaction. Also, when Kirk asks O'Brien who started it.
I don't know, sir.
Yeah. Oh my god, I just lied to Captain Kirk.
And, I mean, this whole episode is basically a love letter to the original series. Like, the whole, like, the Deep Space Nine cast are all super excited to be back in the TOS time, especially Sisko and Dax. They are practically giddy, being like, you know, Sisko being like, I really want to meet Captain Kirk. I'd shake his hand. I want to talk to him about the Gorn. And it's like, why does everyone want to talk about the Gorn?
Because they're Gorn. Why not?
Well, and the thing I liked about it was, like, you know, they team up and they, you know, divide and conquer. Basically, you know, O'Brien and Bashir go off and do their, you know, their part of it. And I like how O'Brien is just like, you know, just dealing with it. Like, okay, whatever, you know, you don't touch anything. It's, you know, he's checking out the equipment, you know, the old computers. But then with the Bashir immediately jumps to, like, this ensign, you know, gives him the fluttery eyes and, like, says, hey, come do my physical tomorrow. And he's immediately jumping into, that's got to be my grandmother. Like, I never met, nobody knew about my great-grandfather, so it's destined that I have to be my own. And it's, like, weird to see how, you know, funny to see the way that each character deals with it. But especially Dax, she's kind of, like, in the role of the audience, like, you know, the nostalgia.
She's all nostalgic, yeah.
And, like, you know, wanting to go shake everybody's hand, wanting to play with the toys of the tricorders and everything. And
wanting
so
to meet up with her old friends.
Yeah, there's a bit of, like, with Dax, she's in the position of being someone who's seen all the TOS episodes, because, you know, she has memories of people who have lived through this time. So I think that was, you know, that was really cool. And also, I love the conversation that Dax and Sisko have when they're talking about going over to see Kang. And I almost feel like that was a conversation between two of the writers where they were like, we could have Dax, like, meet Kang. And the other writer was like, we can't do that. That would be too hard. Like, yeah, but it would be really fun. That's kind of almost what that felt like to me.
I thought it was Koloth.
Was it Koloth?
Yeah, it was Koloth.
Oh, my bad. Koloth. Sorry, Bob.
One of them Klingons.
Don't be sorry to me. I'm not the Klingon guy here.
Yeah.
That's fair.
Kang shows up later on the Voyager episode, which I thought was cool, and we could jump, you know, deal with that later. But it was fun, and, you know, they redo certain scenes. Like, some of it, they just take the original TOS footage and then insert the digitally insert the DS9 people. Other times they like recreate the sets, in especially for the bar scene where it's like you see Odo and Worf actually sitting on tables that were, you know, built brand new for this show.
Can I also just say for a second, we really get to see kind of a whimsical side of Odo in this episode.
Yeah, like
we get to see him being really snarky to Worf and playing around with Tribble and having fun at his expense. We don't get
our
to see
song
Odo...
still sung of the Great Tribble Hunt.
Yeah, we don't get to see him do that a lot, and that's part of what makes the episode funny. Like that, even Odo is in the position of being like, "This is ridiculous."
Well, if you watch the course of the thing, like Odo is about, he's serious, he's about business, like let's get it done, let's get our man, because he's, you know, the constable on after a perpetrator, a perp or whatever. Like we got to get, as soon as he sees the Tribble, that's when it all changes for him, and he's like, you know, petting it, having fun, he smiles, and that's when he's playful with Worf and teasing him. But then, as you know, then later in the thing, like, oh, there's Darvin, now let's get back to business and be serious and catch
our man.
He knows
how to get serious. Yeah,
plus all the actors are just like having fun with all these old props, you know, they're fiddling around with the old tricorders and
your
flap
is open.
Yeah,
also I mean, like that whole scene with Bashir, that's just Bashir making fun of like science fiction time travel cliches, right, where you know you have to, you know, either become your own grandfather or like go back and do something that you were always meant to do. And the episode's kind of like, okay guys, they're kind of winking to us and be like, all right guys, we're gonna be silly, but we're not gonna be that silly. You
yeah.
guys can all calm down.
Although it would have been kind of funny to see Bashir end up in a kind of Marty McFly situation. That would have been pretty great.
Just have like O'Brien get shot by some Libyan terrorists, but then it turns out he was wearing a bulletproof vest.
Have Bashir going around on a hover skateboard. It'll be awesome.
I feel like you could make that claim about almost all of these characters. Now, all right, so that's
hoverboards
pretty much,
make everything better.
Like that's pretty much this episode, like in a nutshell. Like there isn't that much more to say about it, just because it is so, like, the story is very simple and like stays out of the way, because it's like, we need to find this thing, and that's an excuse for us to go all around the old, you know, TOS sets and make new sets. And they did a pretty good job. Like, they did a much better job recreating the bar than they ended up doing later with these other voyages, because that episode, 10 Forward, doesn't look like 10 Forward.
Well, and I like you said, the story doesn't get in the way. Like, it moves along, and it's the premise is basically Arn Darvin is up to no good again. He's trying to do a scheme, and of course it unravels and doesn't work out for him. And then we just get to see the, you know, the fun and experience it along with the crew along the way. And then, of course, it all wraps up nicely at the end, except all the work, all
yeah.
the time and effort that the Klingons put into eradicating the Tribbles, and Starfleet has to bring them back, and we see the promenade covered with Tribbles, and it's like, oh, man.
They probably got better Tribble detecting technology and stuff now. Just tell yourself that extermination ability has gotten probably a lot better.
So, Bob, you
if not, they can have non-week on the promenade, and it'll all be awesome. A little so, on-station coal never hurt anyone. Oh, except for the whole genocide thing. Never mind.
Plus, I mean, we've seen how fast these Tribbles breed. They get into everything. I don't think you want people running around with phasers trying to shoot Tribbles. That would probably not be a great plan.
Batleths only.
Yeah, stick to close range. Now, Bob, you haven't said a whole lot. What do you think about this episode?
I traveled through time once. It was awful.
Also, as a story, this episode works really good as just being a MacGuffin episode, I think. If you don't know what a MacGuffin is, it's when like there's a singular object or goal that everyone is working towards. And I like how they kind of switch MacGuffins for every act in the story to keep it interesting. Like first it's the orb, they're taking care of the orb, that's what's causing the plot. Then they're going after Darvin, that's the plot. And then there's a bomb and a Tribble, we have to find this one singular Tribble, and then that's the plot. And it works, it keeps things interesting, and it's it makes it easy to follow, and it keeps things lighthearted and goofy.
You get to keep everything, you know, keep everything moving. We don't get bogged down in trying to do something that's more serious than what we're
actually
doing.
Unlike Voyager episode we're going to talk about.
Well, one quick thing, like about Dax and some of the characters, like in the role of the audience, and for the people who watch TNG and DS9 but didn't watch the TOS episodes or the original series, I liked that one scene where they're having to suit up and get into the costumes of the past, and of course their hairstyles change. And they walk, and but Sisko and O'Brien walk out, and Bashir takes the role of the audience who might not have seen TOS, saying, "Aren't you guys wearing the wrong color?" And then Dax walks out.
But then
and
he
it's
gets
like,
the doctor line for those who have seen it.
Yep, exactly. There's another reference to the so it was just cool. And then there was so watching the uniforms and then watching Worf and Odo in basically like the Cyrano Jones style traitor with pockets everywhere. It was just fun to see the characters.
I love seeing them in the generic background character outfits.
Oh, and then the thing that I thought was cool is from this episode, we see Dax in the TOS, red miniskirt dress of the, from that era. But at last year's Vegas, Terry Farrell wore basically that same similar outfit, basically like the red TOS when she was in the costume contest. And so it was cool that just having, one of the actors, one of the Trek celebrities be in the costume contest, but Terry Farrell put on, and it was like the t-shirt kind where it's like, it's not the full like Anovos, everything about, exactly like the uniform on the show, but she put on, the red dress, and so it was kind of like reliving that scene where she, and I remember she said in interviews that she had so much fun doing that episode that she, that's one of her favorite memories of, DS9 is doing that episode.
All right, so there's really one thing to talk about before we go on to the Voyager episode and do a compare and contrast, and that is the orb. So I love the implication in this episode that the prophets wanted this episode to happen, because in most episodes
the prophets are fanboys, man.
They kind of
that's
make
what we
it
can
clear,
gather from this episode.
Yeah, they kind of make it clear that the orbs only work when the prophets want them to, like, which is why Kai Winn can't just, like, she has a couple of times when she opens an orb and is like, "I want to have an orb experience," and the orb is like, "Nuh-uh, you stay where you are, lady." So I
didn't
like the
Arn Darvin
not
somehow
for you.
Somehow mess with it, because like he
Kira does too. She's the one that gets them back,
right? And that's why, like, because like Arn Darvin is just some Klingon pretending to be a human. Like, really, he opened the orb and was like, "This will take me back in time." And the prophets were like, "That sounds like a great idea." And they were like, "Guys, enjoy your Tribbles episode, because season 6 is going to be rough. Like, have some time while you can. Have some fun while you can." That's what's going on with the prophets in this episode.
Well, they
this
also
was just
like
the sorry.
The whole thing with them, they don't understand the linear time, and the so they're like, "Hey, they want to play around with the past and the present, or the past and the future," and all that. So like, "Hey, let them have some fun."
Go for it.
All right. So we're moving up so we're pretty much at the end of this episode. But again, Bob, if you have something more you want to say on this, so we're not all just running on over you, take your time.
I'm waiting for someone to mention the difference in Klingon ridges and lack thereof. Surprised I haven't come up yet.
We don't talk about it with outsiders.
Yeah, I was hoping you'd say that.
Rude.
I was just trying to respect David's cultural feelings, okay?
Yeah, Bob. Way to wreck it for everyone.
But I do like that they address that. I mean, obviously you have to if you're going to have Worf, in that classic. And I also like on one hand that they didn't try to explain it fully right away, like, they acknowledged it, but then kind of moved on and made, poked fun at it. But I noticed watching it again that they're like, "So Worf, what happened?" And O'Brien says, "Well, like, was it genetic engineering?" But then Bashir says, "Was it a viral mutation?" And in a way, he kind of nailed it, because it was, so that was kind of cool. Maybe that served as their inspiration for later in the Enterprise, how to explain it. But so that was cool, seeing that, Bashir had the instinct or the thought of, like, but it was like, O'Brien thinking of like engineering, basically, like, biologically. But, he was thinking about tinkering, and Bashir automatically went to a medical explanation. So that was cool.
Yeah, I haven't
But did
noticed
you
it.
see when they recreated, like they recreated the bar scene and the, you know, some of the people that O'Brien had to fight were like new actors, not from the. Did you see how they recreated, you know, the TOS Klingon uniforms, and they like looked exactly alike. They did a good job of recreating it. But there's a couple Klingons that I think had like some funky wigs on, because I'm like, that don't look like normal Klingon hair, and that don't look normal or natural. And so, you know, stuntmen maybe having some wigs or something. So I was like, some of them Klingons don't look quite right.
There's something off about this Klingon wig. All right, so let's talk about Flashback, which is the Voyager episode commemorating the same anniversary. And
Yeah.
this is the premise where they go inside Tuvok's brain and hang out on the Excelsior. So sorry, Bob, no actual time travel this time.
It's mental time travel.
But we do
This
get to hang
episode's
out.
just mental in general.
We do get to hang out on the Excelsior. Oh, so Grace, it sounds like you have a beef with this episode. Why don't you go for it?
It was really boring.
Oh, you
Just
thought
so
so?
boring.
Well, that's why
So
you
boring.
skip all the parts that aren't the Excelsior.
That's the problem, though. It's just too wordy to skip those parts. If you do, you have no idea what's going on.
No, it's great. It's just the Excelsior, and you've got Janeway and Tuvok just hanging out on the Excelsior while they're doing cool stuff. The whole episode's like, I think, 20 minutes long at that point. You don't have to suffer much.
Well, and what I think is like is being addressed, or the issue that is leading to these comments, is like we said about trials and tribulations. They set up a story to, like, you know, serve the plot, or the but it, the story didn't get in the way. And in this case, they had so much going on with Tuvok and his, you know, all that, that I think in a way some of the story got in the way of, like, well, got in the way of what? And that would be enjoying, you know, and celebrating the past and seeing Xulu and all them. It was kind of convoluted, and, you know, it could be hard to follow if you're not catching all the references of, you know, what's going on with his brain, and, you know, then this memory engram thing. And so, yeah, I think I still liked it. I mean, I enjoyed this episode. Well, here's why I enjoyed it. Basically, like Bob was saying, the Excelsior parts, because that's memories, right? So it's not like some alternate timeline where, you know, they're going to undo everything, or, you know, whatever. This is addressing memories from Tuvok. And so if you look at what would have happened, you know, the reality that he experienced, it adds to the fabric. It adds more to this, basically the Star Trek VI story. And you mentioned Kang earlier, and so when I watched Star Trek VI, the Undiscovered Country, there were times where I was thinking, like, I want to see more of Captain Sulu. Like, what are they doing when we flip over to see the Enterprise crew? Like, so what are they doing? So now we get to see, you know, more about what happened with Captain Sulu and the Excelsior. And I liked that they added Kang into the mix. That, you know, if you put the whole series of events together, Captain Sulu and the Excelsior had to deal with Kang at some point when they were trying to help Kirk and do the whole thing. And so I just like, you know, that now we have awesome Klingons with, you know, Gorkon and Chang, and now Kang is in the mix, if you were like put the whole timeline pieces together. And it was Kang in his prime, like, you know, in his full ridged prime, because when he came back for Blood Oath on DS9, they were all old and gray. But this was like Kang, you know, in vibrant, virile, you know, awesome Kang action.
Nice alliteration.
Plus, he's got his nice little battle cruiser going on. So I think what is dragging this episode down a little bit is this weird virus thing having to do with this flashback on this little girl. Like, it really just feels like it should have been something that was happening on the Excelsior that was the issue, because the little girl kind of distracted me. It was like, little girl on a ridge, and now we're on the Excelsior? Wait, hang on a minute. And to be fair, at least Tuvok acknowledged that. He was like, I have no idea why my brain brought us here. This doesn't seem to have anything to do with this little girl that I don't remember. But maybe it would have been better if they had focused more on the Excelsior, because we all seem to agree that the Excelsior bits are the fun parts, like that 20 minutes of
Yeah, and
Excelsior.
to not have that be the main focus, it feels like is kind of a waste of what of the potential that they had, and also of bringing back all these original actors, of having Sulu and Rand and Kang all there.
And
That's cool. That's really awesome. Yeah, and
Dimitri, they brought back the guy, that one guy, so he was cool.
It was
Man,
cool that
that guy.
they gave the red shirt a plot. That's kind of nice, but still, it feels like all that is wasted when it's just made set dressing. for this convoluted ass episode.
You can tell he got older, because there's shots where it's Star Trek 6 footage, and there's shots where it's, you know, a little more current footage where it's being produced. What was this, 96? So when it was shot in 96, you can tell that the actor who's playing Dimitri Valtain, that makeup is not helping him with how much older he was. I mean, it's only 5 years we're talking to, but man.
Well, it's been a rough 5 years.
It has. If you look at him, he's just like, woof.
Dying took a lot out of him.
I did.
And he just kept dying.
And I mean, they made that joke with Sulu, actually, because it's like Decay looked a little bit older too by that point, and they were, you know, and so they made the joke that he doesn't look anything like his picture, and they were like, yeah, well, his picture wasn't accurate.
Holographic technology was not as the bit rate. I mean, the bits pixels per.
They airbrush everything out these days.
That's like, you know, we've talked about the ship and other thing, and I think the big thing that makes this episode awesome is we get George Takei. Sulu is back in effect. We get more Captain Sulu, which I just like. I always wanted to see more of Captain Sulu, and there's the audio books, you know, the audio fiction adventures of Captain Sulu. This was cool. We got to see him, you know, in the chair and talking with Kang. The thing I noticed that also was they tried to, like, you know, tweak, they added to the storylines of, you know, tweaking what would be in Star Trek 6. So if you watch Star Trek 6 again, you're thinking, oh, this is different, or this, because there's the whole little sub thing about young Tuvok made Vulcan spice tea for the captain, and they're like, oh, you're trying to get a promotion, huh? And he's like, that's not my intent. But then, if you watch Star Trek 6 and the whole teacup and everything, now you could think, oh, that's Vulcan spice tea that Tuvok made for him or whatever. So, like, they're trying to, like, tweak it and, you know, add to the fabric.
It makes for a nice addendum, yeah.
And I like the speech between Sulu and Tuvok, where he's like, young Tuvok, obviously it's old Tuvok reliving it, but, you know, it would have been young Tuvok saying, you're breaking orders, these is against regulations, and then we get the cool Sulu speech about, those people saved my life several times over, I'm going to go help them no matter what. So it was just cool to see, you know, Sulu stepping up.
Now, that's an interesting point. So this is like a plot thing, but I want to bring this up because I noticed it. What we see in this episode is that the Klingons are being really generous to the Federation, because picture the situation. We have an incredibly tense...
Well, they
tense...
had just been in peace talks.
Well, but no, they hadn't yet, because
oh, yeah.
What we have is an incredibly tense situation where the Chancellor of the High Council has been killed, theoretically by Federation agents. There's a trial going on for those Federation agents who have been accused of killing him. Like, you know, everyone's on super high alert. The Excelsior attacks a Klingon ship and then just flies into their territory and gets into a space fight. Apparently the Klingons just wrote that off. They were just like, yeah, we're okay with that. We'll forgive you that time.
Well, I don't think they really attack the ship until later, because we get to see the whole build up to the Praxis, incident. And then, so we get to see that. Then it flips to more Janeway and Tuvok. But then here comes Kang, and they're, you know, in this little nebula cloud thing. And they're like, you know, oh, and Sulu was like, oh, we just got off course. Our instruments failed us, you know, because they went to go investigate the practicing. So Kang is like, well, let me just take you back to your space. And then that's when, you know, they shoot the nebula and disable the ship. So I don't think they attacked him right off the bat. Kang was just like saying, hey, what are you guys doing here? Like, go back to your side of the fence, or, you know, your side.
Well, there's not much the Klingons really could have done anyway. I mean, there's in Star Trek 6, we see, you know, Azad Bor, you know, makes a declaration that any rescue attempt will be construed as an act of war. And, you know, we obviously see in this episode the Excelsior is off trying to do a rescue mission. Now, logically, if we're thinking about this in a very straightforward manner, it'd be like, oh, why didn't the Klingons just declare war? It's like, well, you know, they're, as is stated, you know, in both the episode and the movie, Praxis is their key energy production facility. So this would be similar to a situation that would have come around if they had decided to declare hostilities to, like, what we had in World War II with the Battle of the Bulge. Yeah, Klingons could have bloodied the Federation's nose, but if they've got nothing to power their starships with after so long, they're just going to get trampled over. So the Klingons, while they could have declared war after the, you know, spat with the Excelsior going around, they just would have been in the position of just being utterly steamrolled afterwards. You know, so it's mutually beneficial to both the Federation and the Klingons for the Klingons just to kind of look the other way and go, yeah, that I don't know what you're talking about with that. No Excelsior starship came into our space and kicked the shit out of kicked crap out of you know, our Klingon battlecruisers. No, it didn't happen. Yeah, that's similar to like what happened with like you know, during the Cold War, where the U.S. had U-2 spy planes flying over Russia taking pictures. You know, Russia couldn't at the time shoot them down, right? But they didn't acknowledge that they were there. I mean, they totally knew that the U-2 spy planes were flying over, and Russia had made this declaration that, you know, we're not cool with any spy planes flying over like that. But they never publicly acknowledged the spy planes were flying over because they didn't have the capability to shoot them down. But they did not want the world to know that.
That's true. Until they did eventually. Then that was a problem.
Well, yeah.
But what I was thinking, like, to me, with this analogous felt kind of like, imagine if during the Cuban Missile Crisis, an American, like, cruiser had just, like, sailed up into Russian waters and gotten into a shooting match with, like, a Russian ship, is kind of what I imagine this being like. But, I mean, you could be right, is that the Klingons, like, you know, Azabur made that really strong statement of, if you try to rescue them, it'll be war, but she knew that they couldn't back it up, and that was just political rhetoric. That's a possibility.
Well, it is, and that it's all posturing is what it is. So let's say that the Federation did engage, or Starfleet at least, did engage in a rescue mission and rescued these men after the Klingons had made such a declaration, right? Now, if the Klingons didn't back it up, they'd have to, you know, they'd look poor. But I think the Federation would look even more poor after an incident where Starfleet agents had gone over and killed them. I mean, like, the whole galaxy's looking like, or at least the known galaxy at the time, is looking in like, yo, it looks like Starfleet just killed that guy's chancellor over there. That's not really cool, guys. You shouldn't have done that. So it really behooves Starfleet to not go rescue these guys for the sake of looking good. I mean, we do the same thing right now in, you know, the political stage. You know, there's a lot of things that we as the United States can go do. There are some pretty jerk things that we do around the world. There's a lot of things that we don't do as well, just for the sake of trying to look good in those capacities. And this would be a situation that's very similar. You know, Colonel West, you know, in the office is like, yeah, we could go rescue them. And we could totally kick their butts too if they just decided that they wanted to start some crap with us, which, you know, I think is probably true given, you know, what I've already gone over, you know, Praxis being destroyed, their energy is gone, which would be analogous to fueling your war machine with oil through, like, you know, again, like Battle of the Bulge kind of stuff, you know, where the Nazis pushed their tanks through, but they ran out of oil, so they couldn't go any further. They ran out of fuel. Same idea.
We're out of gas, here. Guys.
Everyone back to the motherland.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, it is this situation where it's just like, we have all these pieces on the board. We're trying to move them around for positioning's sake to not get into a battle of attrition so much as we are just trying to outmaneuver each other.
Yeah, that makes sense. This also exposed a bit of a plot hole in Star Trek VI, which was that, and it makes a little more sense if you consider Bob's explanation, but in Star Trek VI, I realized that after, like, Chang knows that the Enterprise has rescued Kirk and Bones from Ruripente. And theoretically, if he had just revealed that fact, that might have led to this war he really wanted. But if we assume that, from Bob's statement, that Chancellor Azabur would probably have not gone to war anyway because she knew that it was a war they couldn't possibly win, maybe that's why he didn't do it. He felt like he needed
Well, I don't think Chang really wanted all-out, like, official war. I mean, he wanted to stop the peace, you know, the alliance and the peace talks. And then he wanted to battle Kirk, so in a way he wanted, you know, combat, or, you know, he wanted to test his mettle and, you know, go up against a worthy adversary. He wanted to battle Kirk, but I don't think Chang wanted all-out war, or he wouldn't have used, you know, a bird of prey that would cloak and fire. He would have just went out and, you know, shot outright, whatever, but I don't think Chang fully wanted, you know, both governments to, like, declare a, you know, sanctioned full-out war type of thing. Just going back slightly, the thing I noticed about Kang and the Excelsior was right when they're first, you know, having their conversation where Sulu's like, oh, we're sorry, we just, you know, our navigational thing. Kang says, it's nice to see that you got the command that you deserve. So it was a nice thing that, you know, showing a level of respect that you know, it wasn't Kang scoffing at Sulu going, you know, get out of here, you know, you piece of crap or whatever. It's like it was respecting him. Of course, you know, over the time of all the TOS.
Two gentlemen meeting on the battlefield.
And, you know, I'm sure Kang would appreciate that Sulu is a swordsman, you know, with some martial prowess there. So that was just
Ooh,
a cool little
I'd pay
thing.
To see that. Have George Takei fight Klingon.
That would be pretty
Klingon.
Boss, yeah.
I disagree that Chang just wanted to fight Kirk. In fact, I vehemently disagree that Chang just wanted to fight Kirk.
No, not that that wasn't his primary goal, but like he even says, like, it's a shame we haven't met on the battlefield. It's not that that was like a goal he was trying to achieve. It's just that, like, his personality, his nature, like, he would have wanted to have that battle, but he was trying, his goal or mission was to stop the peace talks and to do the assassination and all that. So it wasn't that he was trying to have a battle with Kirk, but I just think between the two, like, full out governmental wars, or, you know, fighting Kirk, he would have wanted more just to fight Kirk, but his goal at the time was to stop the peace talks.
And that's a possibility. It's hard to say exactly what Chang's motivation was. Just I've always looked at it from the idea that he was trying to start a war in Star Trek VI. Getting back to the episode flashback, I'm sorry guys, I didn't mean to take us on such a tangent. At least it was a Star Trek tangent this time.
Semi-relatable.
Yeah, semi-related. You want to talk about this virus for a minute? Because apparently the reason Tuvok is having flashbacks is because he has a virus. Which
he's having the girl go fall down virus.
Girl fall down. Now, so my
Sad.
First question, as I was looking at this virus, is I'm like, what does this virus do exactly? Like, is it harmful? Does it just live in your brain, like, in, you know, forever?
Makes you sad over the little girl fall down.
Well, having actually reviewed and watched this episode prior to coming on the show.
Say what now, Bob?
Well, I watched the episode, and I can answer your questions.
Oh, so cool,
virus,
please do.
The virus itself seems to act a lot like how the AIDS virus acts. You know, because when you get AIDS or so, it isn't like immediately start being a problem. I mean, it is a problem, and it will develop into a very big problem, as it kind of did for Tuvok. You know, it'll start to infiltrate your immune system and, you know, kind of start making it not work as well. And that's what was happening to Tuvok, is that it was infiltrating into his, you know, neural structure, and eventually just got to the point where it started degrading. It was lying dormant for a long time, but it just became a problem for him, you know, during the, or just before the episode, really. And the way it was manifesting, one of the symptoms was that girl falling. When the, what was kind of being waxed at the end of the episode, talking to the doctor and I think Tuvok and Janeway, is that it was a memory of some kind from somebody somewhere that was just hitching a ride with the virus.
And the doctor said that there are different, you know, viruses, different, you know, virus things that get in the body and mimic being a blood cell or mimic being something else so that the immune system doesn't attack it. And the impression I got was, and from what they were saying, was like this little Imgram wanted to just, you know, find a way to get into your system, not be attacked by your immune system and you know, killed off so that it could just, you know, live, like be in your brain. And so that's why it pretended to be a memory Imgram. And I took it as that Tuvok has had this the whole time since the Excelsior, but they're getting next to this big cloud with ceruleum or whatever. And I kind of made, and then who knows what was in that drink that Neelix gave Tuvok at the beginning. So
it's
I thought
Neelix's fault.
Either it was Neelix's drink or the ceruleum cloud nebula thing or the combination. But that's like why it was right after that he started freaking out with this memory that got, and it was a trippy little scene where it's like that memory Imgram virus thing. It's like, it gets nested into your, you know, brain, just sits there and wants to live out, do its thing. But it's been passed from person to person, and that's why, you know, Dimitri gave it to Tuvok. But then there's that weird scene where it's like we flash through all the different people that have had that, you know.
All the different little children dropping her, and it's just really weird. There's like a stereotypical Eskimo, there's an Asian guy, it's so damn goofy that it's hard to take
the
ending seriously.
African Zulu kid, and then it goes to a caveman kid.
It's just what would have been hilarious seriously
is if we went over to that Inuit kid and he like woke up and he was like, and they were like, are you okay? And he's like, yeah, I was in this weird place that didn't have any ice or snow. Like, I don't even know what was up with that. Oh, and I guess there was a girl I was dropping, but like, you know, what was up with that land that I was in?
And why was I still wearing my big, you know, parka thing?
Important questions that
Space
need answering.
Parka.
Now, the reason that I brought this up was that the implication of the episode seemed to be to me that he was fine until he saw that nebula that triggered the flashback. And the only reason the memory was hurting him was because of his Vulcan, like, physiology that makes it where if you have a repressed memory, it can, like, actually kill you. And the implication seemed to be that if that wasn't the case, he would just have carried this thing basically forever. And if that's the case, and it's not really hurting him, I don't know if it qualifies as a virus, or at least not as a parasite, if it's just hanging out.
It's more like a minor inconvenience, really.
Yeah. You know, like, I mean, I've got tons of microbes just living inside me right now, and they're not really
the
doing
anything. The toe fungus of the brain.
Yeah, we didn't want to say anything too about
the
but your brain.
The ingrown hair of the mind.
Your brain is just starting to smell a bit. Can you put something on that?
Boom, tough actor to acting.
God damn it, Bob. Also, I thought their solution for getting rid of it was absolutely hilarious because they bombard the brain with thoron radiation. Now, I did some checking, and I found out that thoron is a radioactive isotope of radon, which emits alpha radiation. And the EPA says you should be very careful about alpha
radiation. So their
radiation.
Solution was just to nuke Tuvok's brain until he got better? Oh, wow.
I want to talk to the EPA and be like, guys, so you say not to breathe in anything that emits alpha radiation. What about, like, beaming it directly into your brain? How would that
It's okay, because this guy's a Vulcan, but...
And the doctor kept ramping it up, like, you know, more of it and for longer durations and giving it to both. And Tuvok got, like, mind-linked. And so, like, we can't break the meld. So I think they were giving it to Janeway also, because we had like the little, you know, wave pattern of like, here's the memory in grams, and oh look, the red one that is inside the white one, that's the virus, and then the red little squiggly lines drop down to Janeway's brainwave, so it's like they're getting it back and forth. How does it transmit?
I love what a weird looking kid Janeway is in her flashback.
Oh yeah. Now, we see that Dimitri is about, you know, he's dying, and Tuvok's like, get away, your console's going to explode, and he's like, one more minute, and then he explodes. So he's on the ground. I was wondering, how exactly did that memory engram thing get passed from Dimitri to Tuvok? Like, was he from a blood transfusion, or, you know, like, how exactly
did
it jump into
it? He just did, like, what Spock did to McCoy, and just looked at him and was like, look at me, I live in your brain now, you know?
Yeah, it passed along
like
sadness. Like, Tuvok was sad, and he caught it on the sadness waves.
I don't think this alpha radiation would really be that big of a deal.
You don't think so?
I don't think so.
There's sadness waves, no.
Well, I'm reading the biological effects of it, and it sounds like a big problem for those of us that live in the 21st century. However, from the 23rd century on, we know that, like, kidney problems are solved by, you know, eating a Tootsie Roll.
I suppose that's a fair point. Just regrow Tuvok's brain.
Alpha radiation ain't a problem for, you know, 24th century doctors. Like, yeah, whatever, we're going to bombard him with alpha radiation. They're going to suck it up. Then we give him a lollipop.
That lollipop will fix his brain. Get that.
It will
take
fix
care
his
of that
brain.
Radiation. Right
the
quick.
The lollipop itself will also cure shingles.
That's a pretty effective lollipop. Now,
right?
Where I think this episode works the best, actually, as aside from just getting to see Sulu and Rand, and I really love that they have Rand in here. People always forget about Rand, and I appreciate that she's back.
She's undervalued.
I do think this episode helps with Tuvok's backstory a bit, and I think it helps, you know, it adds a little bit of dimension to him. And apparently Tim Russ had them rewrite the Tuvok's lines a couple of times, because according to him, they were writing things that didn't sound Vulcan. So I don't know what the original script looked like, but I thought that was kind of neat that Tuvok was in, like, that Tim Russ was involved enough in the process to be like, you know, no, I think he would say this instead. And did anybody notice that if you watch this episode, like, side by side with Star Trek VI, you'll notice that Sulu sounds a little bit more, like, panicky in this version? He's a little bit less, like, you know, stoic and, you know, and unflinching. He's a little bit more like, there's a thing.
Maybe that's just how Tuvok remembers him. Maybe
yeah, that's
all
what
humans
I think.
seem totally panicky to him.
I think that's just Tuvok's memory of the event. I think Tuvok just remembers him as being a little overly emotional.
His memory of the teacup scattering across the table seems oddly specific.
He worked hard on that tea, okay, Bob? He worked hard on it.
As well, that's a fair point.
They also
look,
they never...
he had to brew that tea, he had to clean that china.
They never came out and said this, but I also think the implication here is that Tuvok experienced some anti-non-human racism at the Academy, because he had a really, like, bad time, was the implication. He did not enjoy it. And then in that movie, in Star Trek VI, we have them saying that Valeris was the first Vulcan to graduate at the top of her class. And when I saw that at the time, I was just like, how does that make sense? Because Vulcans are, like, super smart. You would think they would always be graduating at the top
of
their
class. It's not like they're slackers, yeah.
Like, and maybe
well,
there are
they
other...
go on those benders where, like, they have the, you know, the parties. Well, and here you brought that up.
Like,
something
Rose
that
Springer
I noticed.
For Vulcans? What?
It adds to Tuvok's, you know, backstory about his past and his parents and everything, but I also saw it as an interesting, you know, comparison between Spock and Tuvok, because in a way those are like some of our main, you know, primary Vulcan characters. And if you go back and look at Spock, the storyline and the, you know, relationship was that Sarek always opposed Spock entering Starfleet. And then we see in the later movie, like he says, maybe I was mistaken, but like, so Sarek, you know, wanted him to go into the Vulcan Science Academy, and, you know, not, he opposed him going into Starfleet. Whereas with Tuvok, his Vulcan parents, like, basically forced him to go into it. And so that was just,
and
like,
what
a
kind
different...
of parents would they be if they're like, oh yeah, go join the humans, it'll be great. I mean, seriously, what is the story behind that is what I kept wondering.
Well, we've seen that Vulcan society seems to have a lot of planned childhood, basically. Like, if we assume that they're still doing arranged marriages, the only reason for that would be because they have this whole, like, when the child is born, the parents, like, set out this whole plan for the child, and they're like, you will have follow this plan because it is the most logical. So maybe his parents were like, yes, we will have a Vulcan in Starfleet, and that will increase our, you know, influence, and then we will be better off for it, and that is the most logical way to do things.
Now, another thing I noticed, what role did he play on Voyager? Wasn't he more like the tactical guy? Or what was his... Because on the Excelsior, he was a science officer. And I could see them thinking, you know, there's the Vulcan Science Academy, but go do, you know, be a science officer in Starfleet, and that'll help Starfleet, that'll help Vulcans to know how Starfleet does their science, whatever. But then I thought, wait a minute, he's the science officer on the Excelsior. What is he on Voyager? He seemed to not... be like the primary science officer on that, the times that I watch, you know, think about their roles. No. Of like,
on Voyager he shoots the guns, he's the security officer and also the tactical officer, which is kind of a problem when they need to send him to go, like, you know, deal with borders in the middle of a space fight. But I think that they did have a good, like, at the very least they did develop Tuvok pretty well. What did you guys think, I just ask each of you, what did you guys think of Janeway's kind of attitude towards TOS? Because in Deep Space Nine, it was very, like, adoring, and everyone was super into TOS, and Janeway has more of, like, a bit of exasperation for the whole thing.
I don't know. I didn't feel like we got to actually get much from Janeway in terms of interacting with the environment. The whole thing seems more like it's just her reacting to Tuvok, specifically.
Well, but
at least that's what
that...
I got.
But there was a, was she talking to Harry Kim? I mean, there
yeah,
was a scene.
Room.
Yeah, there was that scene where, you know, they were talking about, you know, all the past, and, you know, they were slower to invoke the Prime Directive, quicker to, you know, pull out their phasers. And the thing, I thought that was kind of interesting, you know, having
and we get that great handed comment where she says, I would have loved to serve with a crew like them.
Oh,
and I just heard that, and I was like,
you guys
all
suck.
Ouch! Dude, well, that is a wicked burn.
And it was, like, interesting to hear, like, to see and hear, like, a current, you know, from our time. It's obviously, for us, it would be the future, but for Janeway and them, like, a contemporary, modern Starfleet person talking about the differences of how things are, you know, things are done differently, regulations have changed or been enforced differently, and then she makes a comment, like, and their ships were half as fast, like, oh, okay, yeah, no, yeah, no crap. But then she says that the thing that kind of, so that was all fine with me. The thing that I didn't like was when she said they wouldn't last in a day in the current, you know, they would be kicked out or they wouldn't last in the current Starfleet. And I'm like, really? You're going to like say that about Kirk and Spock and all these, like, you know, it would almost be like if a general of the military today said that MacArthur or they, you know, those people in the past, they wouldn't last a day in today's army. It was just weird for her to kind of like nostalgically talk about them and then compare and contrast and then like dismiss them like that.
They would. Kirk would totally, like, you know, give a speech to the temporal investigation guys, like, stop bothering me. Like, important
Kirk,
things to do.
Kirk fool on him.
They would try to, like, you know, lock him up, and he'd be like, you cannot put a man away on the word of a computer, and it's like, this is actually the word of us, and he's like, you guys are basically computers. Just shut up. I don't want to deal with you.
If he was on Voyager, there'd just be a string of ships following him of women he'd slept with being like, hey, come back here! You'd have a woman in every quadrant.
I'm glad they didn't do that.
But yeah, I think I agree with Janeway's sentiment that they wouldn't last as long in, you know, quote unquote today's Starfleet like they could in days past, because the frontier, while space is very big, the frontier is in fact smaller.
Yeah, they would be like, you know, court-martialed, and, you know, we've seen that they would have been, you know, handled differently.
Yeah, I think it was basically she was drawing a distinction between, like, sort of the more adventure type style of the of TOS with the, I'm not going to say more mature, but the more I don't know, the less action oriented, like, new Star Trek. Although that wasn't always true. Like, Voyager spent a lot of time shooting Kazon. It wasn't like they
they have to, you know, do skirmishes or whatever. But, you know, Janeway
always
and
a skirmish.
A lot of the contemporary Starfleet, they don't swash the buckles as much. They're not really, you know, adventuring the same way.
Yeah, so I thought that was interesting, is that to draw the contrast between the Deep Space Nine characters who were just like, this is the greatest thing ever, and Janeway, she's like, she's wistful, but she's also kind of like, yeah, things were different back then. It's a different time now, that sort of thing. I thought it was interesting.
But, and it was capped off with her saying, you know, I would have liked to serve with that, like, even though it's different, and but I would have liked to be there and, like, you know, serve with them. Grace, you mentioned how, you know, Janeway is reacting and going through the Tuvok memory stuff where she's walking around the Excelsior. A thing I noticed about that I wanted to, like, bring up but also get your guys' thoughts on it was, so we see right off the bat when they start the mind meld stuff that she's even asking the questions like, are they going to see me, or what's going to be the deal? And so Tuvok explains that she's going to be like a passive observer. And he even says the line, you're not going to participate in the memory, you're just going to be observing it, right? And she's like, okay, cool. And so that explains why, for the most part, or in the beginning at least, Tuvok was walking around talking to Janeway, but then he would talk to Sulu. But, you know, all Sulu ran, they never would talk to Janeway. Like, they just didn't see her. She was out of it. But the thing I thought was, okay, I get it. But then I'm watching those scenes, and I'm thinking, she's not a participant, just an, you know, observer type thing, right? Every time the ship shakes and they all shake in their chairs and fall down to the ground, Janeway also shakes and falls down and stuff. I'm thinking, if you're not participating in the memory, wouldn't she just be standing up straight and normal while everybody else shakes, because she's not participating in the events or the thing? And so I thought
it was a sympathy shake.
In her mind made it so it happened. I just thought it would be interesting to see, like, if, like, she's walking around, you know, normal, and then everybody else is, like, you know, coughing from the smoke and getting thrown around, and she's just, like, standing like nothing's going on. It could have even had a scene where she's looking around like, oh, look, everybody's, you know, shaking and, you know, almost like addressing it in a way. But I just thought that was trippy to me. Like, you're not a participant, but then she's, like, you know, shaking with everybody else.
Look, when you've been shaking on your ship for like 3 seasons, it doesn't wear off. You know, you're just like, okay, the ship's been hit, I'm going to throw myself around.
We're in shake mode.
It's a psychosomatic response.
Pavlovian, if you will.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So I think that's, we've covered most of what's in both of these episodes, and we're a little bit past when we were looking to end this week. So I'll just go down and get some final thoughts on this. Bob is our guest. Would you like to go first? Final thoughts on Flashback as compared to the Trials and Tribulations?
Compare the two?
Or just, you know, whatever. Final thoughts on Flashback in general.
Excelsior rocks in flashback. I need more of that. I need my Excelsior fix.
That's fair. That's and for I mean, sure. Was there anything you wanted to talk about that we didn't get to?
No.
Okay, very good. More Excelsior. Roger. David, how about you?
Well, I definitely enjoyed the DS9 episode more, just because it was in a way meant to be more fun, more, you know, playful and nostalgic. But I did enjoy the Voyager episode. I mean, it was kind of, you know, a convoluted, science-y plot about Tuvok's mind and memories and stuff. But I kind of liked how they were trying to blend the two together. And, you know, it wasn't just a time travel episode, that it's like exploring the mind. And but I definitely enjoy, my favorite parts of it is all the, you know, Captain Sulu and seeing how they not just rehash Star Trek VI, but try to like tweak it and add to it. That was kind of a, you know, I appreciate seeing Kang, and, you know, because before we would have never seen Kang, you know, thought of Kang being involved in those events. But because of this episode, we get Sulu exchanging with Kang and, you know, different little things like that. So I like both episodes.
All right. And Grace, how about you?
Well, we kind of see an explanation of the Excelsior China set, I guess. Which
that was
is
important.
Interesting. Yeah, that was important. It mattered now. And that
you know
it,
what I want for Christmas.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness. If I can find one of those, Bob, it would be yours.
Yeah. Good times. But yeah, it was an episode that could have done a lot more than it did, but it was cool to see them bring old actors back, which was fun and appropriate, it felt like.
All right. Well, thanks, Bob, for joining us this week. It was good to have you on.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right. Now, we all have to purge viruses out of our brain with alpha radiation and then get some brain-restoring lollipops. So until next week, this will be...
I want to play with those Vulcan building blocks that Tuvok had.
Right? He gets to, like, build a Vulcan house of cards there, and that's what he does for Vulcan school homework, I guess.
On a side note, I would also watch House of Cards cast entirely with Vulcans.
Who wouldn't?
So you can think about that.
I wouldn't watch that. That'd be dumb.
So you can think about that. And if you want to contact us, please do so at allthingstrek@hotmail.com. And until next week, this will be All Things Trek, signing off.